seconds.
One time for the underdog.
One time for the underdog.
Ignition sequence start.
Let me see you put 'em up. Reach the sky, touch the stars up above. 'Cause it's one time for the underdog. One time for the underdog.
You know, a lot of times when you're coming up in business or you're trying to become an executive or CEO, whatever you're trying to do as an entrepreneur, there comes a time in your life where you have to make a very, very difficult decision that there is no book that you can go to that's going to tell you this decision to make. And that's exactly what happened to the most powerful woman in the world in India. She's recognized on Fortune as the most powerful woman in the world. She's recognized on Forbes as the most powerful woman in the world. She went from working with a bank as a regular employee to eventually becoming the most powerful person in this bank with 250,000 employees, you know, 25,000 different branches, the number one biggest bank in India. But that decision is so pivotal, you need to catch that decision. You're probably gonna wanna share this with every woman, your wife, your girlfriend, your sister, anybody you know, because at some point, someone's gonna have to make that same decision if they wanna get to the next level. Enjoy this interview.
SBI's former chairman, Arundhati. Thank you so much for taking the time and welcoming us into your place. It's been a wonderful experience being in India. And yesterday, you and I were both speaking at the IIT Summit, and we were in the back talking, and then the news folks came, and I'm like, listen, I'm trying to speak to this woman. I'm trying to learn from her, and everybody's distracting. And so I'm glad we had the time to get back together here today. So to put things some things into perspective, you know, your career has been absolutely amazing. In India, you're obviously celebrated by a lot of different people. You took a bank that's been around since 1800s, I believe, right? SBI has been around for a while. And recently, before you leave in, you had five associate banks that I think came together, which made SBI now the 50th largest bank in the world. Mm-hmm. I think you guys have 278,000 employees. I'm trying to see if I'm getting the numbers right. Half a billion customers. Right?
That's right.
24,000 branches you have, give or take, the numbers that I'm saying. And you're the chairman running this entire company. So before you became this person, how did the whole thing get started initially for you?
I joined the bank a long time back. In fact, I served it for 40 long years.
So now you and I, when you were talking yesterday, you were sharing with me that, you know, I asked you, I said, so is it very common for a woman to be running banks? And some of the stories you were telling me was fascinating because you are the first chairman of a Fortune 500 company that's based out of India. I think you're the first
to
do that.
That's right.
But are there a lot of other women that are running banks and major financial firms here in India? Is this becoming a very normal thing?
Yes, it has. It has. Because if you look at the largest private sector bank, that's also run by a woman. And she's been running it now for the past 7 years. Then the number three private sector bank is also run by another woman. At one point of time, the number two public sector bank also had a woman as the leader. In fact, even foreign banks in India, a number of them are led by women. So whether it be Bank of America, Standard Chartered, Morgan Stanley, HSBC at one point of time, she's also just retired. So a large number of foreign banks in India also have women as their heads.
Why is, I ask you this question, and I'm gonna ask it again. Why do you think that is there a reasoning? Is it the fact that, you know, is it because culturally in India, the women make the decision for money, or it just so happened that women came up in the leadership position?
I don't think culturally women make the decision where money is concerned. I think what happened in 1969, the Indian government went in for nationalization of banks. And the idea was that banks weren't really expanding and spreading out towards the villages and getting more and more people or providing more and more banking services to people. So the mandate on nationalization was expansion at a very fast pace. And when that happened, you know, a lot of jobs came into being. And in those days, there weren't too many opportunities for jobs. The private sector wasn't as vibrant as it is today, and you needed to know people in order to sort of, you know, get a job. So that is when I think, you know, a lot of women got in, because they felt that this was an opportunity that you could avail of on the basis of merit alone. So you needed nothing other than
that's phenomenal. That's exactly
yes.
what you want.
That's right. You know, but the fact remains that in India, this is something really strange. But we had calculated at one point of time when I was chairman, About 55% of banking assets were being led by women.
That's unbelievable.
That's
55%.
That's right.
I mean, that's...
Because our bank alone is 23%.
You know what would be fascinating is for Harvard to do a case study on India. Because I think if they keep talking about, you know, inequality and, you know, all the gender equality, all this around the world, this is not just an America thing, it's all over the world. This will be a very interesting case study to see what happened in India that caused where 55% of the money is being controlled by women. What was the reason behind that? But so I guess my next question for you would be, you talk about the fact that you traveled a lot and you're married, your husband's also a career person. He's an ex-professor of IIT. Which one is
Kharagpur.
Okay, so
that's in the east.
That's in the east.
Yeah.
And you're growing, you're traveling, you're having to do all this stuff. And you also have a daughter, you have a child as well. Was there a point where in your career you were going where you hit a marker where you had to make a decision that was extremely difficult within your personal life? And if you did go through that, what decisions did you have to make? How did you process that to say, because I can't see somebody like yourself being the most powerful woman in India and not having at some point where you have to make some very difficult decisions that somebody may say, you know what, I'm just going to be a mom. I'm just going to sit home. Did you go through that? And if you did, could you tell us about it?
As you rightly said, I think there is hardly a woman who has a family who doesn't go through that at some point of time. Yes, I did go through it. And luckily, probably I had the right kind of support structure to enable me to get past it. For instance, when I got posted to New York, my child was very, very small and she needed special care as well. Very luckily, my aunt who had just retired and she lives with us, so she agreed to come along with me.
To New York?
To New York, okay, to look after the child. So that was really a godsend and things worked very well. I left for New York alongside of her. And for 1.5 years, things were fine. But then the immigration attorney, he told us that, you know, probably, you know, you will not be able to get another extension of visa. She was getting a 6-month visa. So she got 2 extensions. They said, you know, third time, in all probability, she'll get refused. And if she gets refused, she won't be able to come back to the country again.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's better if she goes back for a year. And then for the remaining 1.5 years of your term, we used to have 4-year terms. She can come back. So this 1 year, fine, if that's the way it should be done, that was okay with us, but what happens to the child? And as you can imagine, the child at that point of time was spending much of her time with my aunt. So both my aunt and my mother back in India, they sort of insisted that it's only a matter of 1 year. She's still very young, so you send her back to India for a year. Okay, and obviously, you know, it's been one of the toughest decisions. My husband by that time had joined me. So he said he would support my decision, whatever, but it was mine to take. Okay, so after a lot of, you know, to-ing and fro-ing and trying to understand the pros and cons and talking to the doctors and the counselors and everything, ultimately I decided to send him back to India. But in those days, you know, we had no Skype, no FaceTime, no nothing. And even the phones were very unreliable. We didn't have mobile phones either. So very unreliable phone lines. And in India, sometimes when you called, you could hear a ringing sound, but actually speaking, the person on the other side would probably have a dead phone. So, you know, every morning I would call and every evening I'd call. And if I couldn't get through one of those times, till I got through, you know, I was an absolute pins and needles. And I think all my parents' neighbors, they also came to know about it because, you know, if I couldn't get through on my mother's line, I would get through on one of the neighbors. So they also took to finding out how my daughter was doing. So it was almost a
community,
joint, neighborhood effort to assure me that she was doing fine. You know. But anyway, luckily, after the year was over, she did get a renewal of her visa and she did come back.
Let me ask you, when it comes down to that, if you were to speak to the woman out there, the ladies out there, who are mothers or they're running a business, what could you say to them when it comes down to the processing on how to handle this better? Because men are wired slightly different than a woman. What could you say to them?
See, again, I think, you know, what happens is when you continue to do your best in whichever area you are in, you are setting certain examples, okay? Because at the end of the day, you know, if you are achieving something, it makes everybody around you feel good. And it's good to have people feeling good at home. Okay. I don't think, you know, that small things like whether you're giving them their food or whether you're, you know, standing on beside them as they do their homework, I don't think these are things that are so very important. Okay. And very often what happens is we get sidetracked by certain rules that society puts out for us. Okay. So for instance, in Indian society, the woman of the household is expected to eat after everybody else has eaten. This used to happen in our parents' generation. Now, if you take that as a rule, then, and you are not able to do it, very often you won't be before if you're in a job like mine, then you start having all kinds of guilt feelings, which are absolutely useless, you know, because why should you be bound by, you know, rules that society makes for you? So I think, you know, overall, I don't really believe that, you know, you're shortchanging anybody if you're doing a job there. Okay? Of course, you know, there are times when you need to prioritize. Okay, and that prioritization has to happen. For instance, somebody is sick at home, you need to prioritize. Very often people ask me, how do you do that? Because, you know, there might be a crisis in the office as well.
Sure.
And my short answer to that is that you must have excellent teamwork. And excellent teamwork means that when the leader or a member steps away, the rest can fill in the breach without missing a beat. Okay. So, you know, if you can get your team to be like that, then you can continue to prioritize when you need to prioritize. And there will be times, I fully agree, that you cannot always prioritize office over home. There will be times when home will need it, and similarly vice versa. But for both, you know, you need to have those kinds of teams that can take up the slack immediately and you won't feel missed. Again, I'll tell you, why do people not do that? Because many people are not confident enough to make themselves dispensable. Okay?
Many people are not confident enough to make themselves dispensable.
Yes. You always want to be indispensable. You know? Because you're not confident that even when you're away,
wow,
or even if you've made yourself dispensable, even then you will still be valued and you will,
wow,
still be wanted.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very, very difficult space to
no
be in.
No doubt about it, yeah.
And you're always trying to sort of protect whatever you have so that, you know, if you go away, those others won't be able to manage. If you do that, then you're not going to be able to prioritize one over the other.
What a way of thinking. This traditional way of thinking, this is your way of thinking. That philosophy is, it's incredible. So two questions for you with this, because that part was family, right? What things you had to go through as a family. Now let's talk about, to become a chairman, you have to be a leader. You're not just going to become a chairman without knowing how to sit in boardrooms, manage ego, deal with egos, different personalities, you know, leading men, leading women, customer issues, political issues, diplomatic issues, you know, all these different compliance issues. How do you, one, when leading the team, when a crisis happens, what is your immediate, how are you processing a crisis, whether it's leadership, political, market, whatever it is, how are you processing that as you're leading your team?
As a leader, if you want to be effective, you must be able to get the bigger picture from as few data points as possible. So to the extent that, you know, you should be able to see what you are going to come up against, okay? If you're not able to more or less visualize what is ahead of you and then you just go and hit it, there's a problem. That's one thing. The second thing I think, you know, we have to understand is that you must understand who's good at what. And if you have understood that, and if you understand the broader picture, then it's much easier to delegate the right pieces to the right people. Now, if you do that, what happens is if there is a crisis, then you can immediately call up that particular team and have them sort of start responding, mm-hmm, in a manner that is, that is something which they are capable of doing, or I should say, you know, the speed of response would be very good. So, you know, again, very important to get the right people in place in the right kinds of jobs. Very important to be able to trust your team so that you know that if you tell them to get something done, they will get it done. So how do you understand that? observing them, seeing what they're good at, seeing what they're enjoying doing. I think some of these things do work in, but at the end of the day, it is partly intuition as well.
Got it. Interesting. Okay, and the last question, this will be the last question, is India. I was invited to come to IIT, and initially we were not able to make it work, so finally we came back and decided to come out, and I've completely fallen in love. Mm-hmm. Just the culture, the community, the way it is, it's unbelievable. India now has the sixth largest GDP in the world, right? You are the largest democracy. You are the second largest English-speaking country in the world outside of America. You are now, like, the level of wanting to learn, the hunger factor with these younger entrepreneurs coming up, and, you know, you're having young stories with people that all of a sudden this guy becomes a billionaire, that guy. You have a lot of good stories right now in India. What do you foresee taking place with the economy of India and the opportunity of entrepreneurship in India, especially someone like yourself who has worked with them, because when it comes down to they need money, startup capital, all this, so you're in these conversations. What do you foresee happening with the marketplace of India?
See, one reason why India skipped the manufacturing stage altogether and became a services economy is because Indians are basically entrepreneurs. Okay. However, India is still a developing country. It's not a rich country. So people don't have capital. For becoming a manufacturing nation, you need capital, either your own or that which comes and gets invested here from outside. India had neither. Now, because they had neither, there was no other way for them to go ahead and give play to their entrepreneurial skills unless they got into the services sector, where actually the need for capital is much lower. Okay, that's one of the reasons why we have done so well. The second, I think, important thing about India, and there is a book by one Gurcharan Das. He writes exceptionally well. And if you can read that book, you should. It says India Grows at Night. Okay. So the fact of the matter is, India has always grown from the bottom. It's not a centrally controlled country. The center has never been exceptionally strong. Okay. So the entire entrepreneurial spirit, it stems from the grassroots. And because of that, you know, this country is very different from many others. That is one of the reasons why even today, if you go to tier 2, tier 3 cities, tier 4 mm-hmm. cities, you'll find small businesses, you know, because people are doing something or the other. And that's maybe one of the reasons why, even though we have 12 to 15 million people coming onto the work stream every year, in spite of that, you don't have the kind of social unrest that you would expect, you know, any other such country to have. And that's one of the reasons why I believe, you know, that going forward, this is a country that is very, very well suited to the new age. And the reason for that, again, is that we are evolving at a very fast pace.
I noticed that. You know,
we are changing at a very fast pace. Those people who are very disciplined and rule-bound, they will find it more and more difficult as it goes ahead.
Not more difficult?
Yes, because, you know, they're very rule-bound. So unless the rules are in place, you don't know how to react to it. In India, however, it's good to be disciplined. I'm not saying otherwise. Mm-hmm. It's good to be disciplined. It's good to be rule-bound. But you also need that ability to be able to think, you know, beyond the rules and react if certain things happen. You know, I continue to give this example of demonetization. Demonetization happened in this country. 86% of the notes, of the currency notes, were suddenly considered invalid in the space of one day. 86% of notes in a country which is cash to the extent of 12% of GDP. So it's a bit cash-oriented economy. And yet, we managed. Of course, there were pains. There were pains. But at the end of the day, there wasn't, you know, rioting or looting or anything of the sort. And in 60 days' time, the whole system did manage to get back on its feet. And remonetization, as we called it, happened. So the fact is, I doubt very much whether such a huge exercise could have been done in any other country. Mm. And you can imagine the logistics requirement, because, you know, the new notes had to be printed, they had to be supplied, they had to be taken into the far reaches of the country, and you can't move new currency notes in your pockets.
Sure.
When you move, as it's called, treasure, you have to have security, you have to give them the road plan, you have to get the clearances. If you're moving it around across state borders, both the states should be on board. So, you know, there is a lot of formalities towards, you know, the logistics are quite mind-blowing. But all of that still got done. And we did it without notice. Actually speaking, very few of people believe that there was no notice. But I'm telling you God's own truth, no notice. One day's notice. 8 o'clock in the evening, we get to know. We are told next day is a holiday. And the day after, we are up and running. Only one day in between, the banks were closed. And the next day at 10 o'clock, we all opened our counters and we had new notes to give. Maybe not as many as we wanted, but we had some.
I remember that.
Yes. So, you know, that's what I'm trying to say. That's where I think, you know, the ability of, you know, Indians, maybe it's some kind of a tensile strength that we have. I think that is something that's very important to understand, that, you know, this is a country that will sort of find its way no matter what. And if our leaders are able to do a little more hand-holding and make our path smoother, so much the better.
So you think some of these guys that are all about following the rules and the disciplines, you think the younger generation are the ones that are going to break some rules and create new innovation? Is that what you're thinking?
I should think so, yes.
Got it.
Again, it doesn't do if you have a society that doesn't look at rules or is indisciplined.
Sure.
It doesn't do. But what I'm trying to say is that you have to have the ability to switch from one to the other, given the crisis that you are facing or the situation that you're facing. In the normal situation, great to be absolutely disciplined and rule-bound. But if the situation is normal, not normal, how then do you face it? Are you still able to manage, you know, if you're given a set of circumstances which you never envisaged? How do you get around it? How do you manage in spite of it? I think that's something that's very important.
Incredible.
Thanks everybody for listening. And by the way, if you haven't already subscribed to Valuetainment on iTunes, please do so. Give us a 5-star, write a review if you haven't already. And if you have any questions for me that you may have, you can always find me on Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube. Just search my name, Patrick BitDavid. And I actually do respond back when you snap me or send me a message on Instagram. With that being said, have a great day today. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.